You're listening to the Modern Web Podcast. For more podcasts, videos, and events, find us online at modern-web.org or follow us on Twitter at modern.web. That's modern.web.
Dave Gray covers some of the latest updates to Next.js, including server actions and how to master new frameworks as they get released.
Hey there, welcome to this episode of the Modern Web Podcast. Today I am here with my co-host, Rob Osell. My name is Tracy. You can follow me on Twitter at LadyLeet or LinkedIn as well. We are here with one of our guests today, Dave Gray. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi. Are you on LinkedIn?
I am on LinkedIn.
Do you spend a lot of time there?
Yes, David Gray.
David Gray.
Singer David Gray, so I had to add something to all of my logins.
Nice. And for those of you who don't know Dave, he is a lot of things, but I mean, I ran into you because you are Dave Gray Teaches Code on YouTube, and your courses are really awesome. So it's great to see all that content out there.
Thanks.
Yeah. And he's also a full-time developer at Proven Winners, if y'all have ever purchased their plants at Home Depot. Do they do all the herbs and everything too?
Yeah, I'm not a plant expert. They do a lot of things. I think it's mostly, petunias and things like that. But I do think they have a few herbs. I should know the full catalog, but I don't. I know how to record the data about the catalog.
He's also adjunct faculty at Fort Hay State University. So yeah, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Yeah. So I asked Dave what he wanted to talk about today. And one of his things was Next.js. And I said, oh, yes, of course. We're talking about Vercel or Next.js. And it's Modern Web Podcast roulette, I feel like, or bingo. I don't know if we call it roulette or bingo, but we talk about Next or Vercel on this podcast.
It's a very popular topic right now, I bet. So.
Hashtag not sponsored. But yeah, tell us a little bit about Next and like why you think there's such a big demand for it.
Well, it all started about a year ago, I think, when the new React docs came out. And if you look at the React docs and how they recommend getting started with React, they instantly say, we recommend that you use a framework now. And so I started getting lots of requests that very month, you know, through my YouTube channel about, hey, create a course or create a, you know, a series on Next.js. So I did, which was, you know, during the Next.js 13 releases, and things were changing almost weekly. So, you know, I would go from one video that introduced something, and then the next video, I'd be like, well, okay, this has changed. Make sure you're using this version now. Look at my package JSON to confirm, you know, you're using the same version that I am, so things respond the same way. And it's, you know, fortunately slowed down a little bit here in 14. They said no new APIs when 14 came out. And we're still working with some changes, though. I mean, there's functions that start with unstable right now. You would think that would probably change, but you know, unstable underscore no store and things like that that we're working with right now.
How, like, you know, as an educator, how have you approached learning this? Because, you know, I know you taught web development in universities as well. Like, I know that my university, when I was in computer science, you know, it was teaching Java at the time, which was a little bit behind the times. Not that Java was behind the times, but the way that they were teaching it was. I know they've moved to JavaScript now. Like, what is the state of the educational situation with web development in schools? And do you see that like catching up as time goes on? Or how is it being taught? Like, are we still teaching SPAs? Are we not teaching any of this in college? Like, where are people as a default right now?
That is a great question. And I think every university may be a little different.
Probably.
but let's go back. When you get a course approved, even at a university, the wheels turn slowly. So I have some, you know, wiggle room within my own class that I teach or courses. I teach front-end web development in the fall and back-end web development in the spring. And I can change things in my syllabus and provide that to my department. But if I make any major change, and this would be the course name or something that would be considered more drastic. That has to go through an approval process. And no, I don't think it can keep up with the changes we see in web development. However, I've got enough wiggle room, and I've been teaching at the university long enough. I feel like I can keep it current. However, I don't teach any modern frameworks. I think they change too fast. And okay. Let me explain the structure where I am. Not every university is like this, but I'm in the informatics department there. And it started way back in the 90s when you had the meeting of all the different types of media, and they weren't sure where to put web media. So they put in the campus television station and radio station is all in the same department with web. And that's not in the same department as computer science. So I get computer science students coming over to take the web development courses. And then I still have some media students taking the web development courses as well. So they have different backgrounds, and I really focus on the fundamentals. So the first thing they need to take is an introduction or a foundations course, and that has HTML and CSS. Mm-hmm. And then when they get to my courses, it would be JavaScript on the front end, and I'm teaching vanilla JavaScript. If they learn those fundamentals, then they can get into any framework they would choose or need to after that. And then on the back end, we're learning the fundamentals of REST APIs and the different HTTP statuses and things like that. And the first half of the semester, now not everyone's going to like to hear this, but I still teach PHP because there is a really good chance they're going to get out there and inherit some legacy project and need to know that. So we build a REST API with PHP. And in the second half of the semester, we take everything we learn from there and learn how much easier it probably is to do the same thing with Node.js and Express.
Okay, that's interesting. Oh,
it's like the torture. You have to torture everyone before you got to the easy stuff. That's what it was like for me learning, right? Like all vanilla. And then I remember the person that I was hanging out with, like, you know, a week into it, he's like, oh, should I do it? Should I? And then he gave me Ember, and my entire life changed. But I've stayed a mediocre web developer because I didn't learn the fundamentals.
It's all right. You're never too old to learn, though, right?
But yeah, in the courses I teach, I'm definitely covering those fundamentals. Like, okay, you've got a CORS error. What is that? You know, what's an options request versus your normal GET or POST request that you would say, and how to handle those things. And if they learn how to, with those basics, then whatever they may encounter it with later, they should have a better idea of what's going on. The concepts are the most important.
Part of the reason I ask, though, is because I've heard, like with Next.js and the meta frameworks, that, specifically with Next, because I think with the whole use server, use client, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit, like that, I think, has been just a giant conceptual stumbling block for a lot of people. But I've heard that it's primarily that way for people that came out of the SPA era, for developers that are starting now, and this is their first sort of mental framework they've had to learn about web development. They've taken to it, I've heard, very naturally. It just makes sense to them. So I was kind of curious, as you've been on your own journey, and as you're now leading people on their journey towards adopting Next, you maybe are seeing both sides of this. And I'm just kind of curious how it's been for you, and how some of the feedback you've gotten maybe on your videos has been as for people that what they're stumbling with, or if there's any differences between different communities of people when they're learning.
Another great question. And that's interesting also how you have heard that some that maybe are just starting there aren't having the difficulty with that, because it is a new mental model. And what you're more likely to leave a bad review, right? If you have a bad meal at a restaurant or hotel. So the comments you usually see is I'm going to Vue, I'm never coming back, or things like that. The comments I usually see are the complaints about the difficulties they've encountered. Caching is one of the things that has frustrated everyone, because Next.js wants to serve static content whenever possible. And of course, that would allow it to be cached on CDNs and get it out there faster. And that helps SEO. A blog's a great example of this, where it can just create those static pages and send it back out, not have to regenerate those all the time. And of course, before with a SPA, we were just creating dynamic content. And so you would just see that div with root And maybe that's all the search engine would see. And there were workarounds to try to get the search engines to see some static content. So yeah, we've totally changed that mental model. And some of the stumbling blocks, and I've gone over these in a couple of videos on my channel, but some of the stumbling blocks are realizing that, hey, we don't need to make requests to an API endpoint or what you would call a route handler in Next.js, even though it's possible, because the server components can connect directly to the database, just like we do with PHP, for example. So you can just use that server component to get the data you need. And now they've introduced server actions, which are now stable in Next.js 14. And that's another way to avoid using that route handler. And you could send form data when the form's submitted to that server action, and it can connect directly once again to the database, and then you receive that updated data, and there's no route handler or API endpoint, if you will, involved. So yeah, the mental model has changed quite a bit. And I think that's a couple of the things that I hear time and time again. Caching has tripped people up, and just the thought of, hey, we don't have to send every request to an API endpoint.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's been fascinating, you know, for anybody that's listening to this and is struggling maybe to adapt or thinking that, oh, this should be easier. I will tell you, I sat in a group of architects who were trying to adapt and learn the best ways to use Next. And there was this heated, long conversation about whether a shopping cart, that when you click the shopping cart and it pops open to show you, peek what's in your shopping cart, whether that had to be a server component or a client component, and what the mix was. And then we found a Twitter thread that discussed it, and we were all dissecting it. And you wouldn't think something would be that complicated, that's that simple. But that's kind of like the difference here, is just because it was stateful, because it was visible or not visible, that was enough to tip it over. But then came the curveball, that just because maybe the frame that held that pop-out widget was, say, a client component, didn't necessarily mean that the contents couldn't have been server rendered and then streamed in. And so, I mean, again, if you're listening to this and you were struggling, it's been funny watching architects and senior engineers and everybody up and down the chain take their first steps in a new paradigm and just really be uncertain about how to, you know, what the new patterns are. It's been fun to learn, but it's also very humbling at the same time.
I totally agree with that. A video I just published this morning talks about that interleaving those components, where you can have a server component that can be a child of a client component. And that's confusing at first. Definitely is. You know, you've got use client in there and you're thinking, I've set the boundary. Everything after this is going to be a client component. Well, no, only if it's imported. But if you nest it in there as a child, well, it can be a server component again.
Yeah, right. And that may not be the way that you think. Like, these are the patterns that are being rethought. Another one that we discussed was, I know that this pattern has been disavowed by a lot of the people that originally sort of introduced it, but this sort of like presenter or container component type of pattern, where you have kind of like one overarching parent component that then maybe guides a bunch of smaller ones through a flow. And you have this in the unidirectional data flow in the SPA model, you have these kind of less knowledgeable children that are then eventing up to a parent that's controlling some large flow. And this was really good for like step-by-step processes. Like if you're applying for, say, a loan and that has multiple phases, you maybe have one overarching component and then different components for different pages. And I, again, got a group full of developers together just trying to figure out, what does this pattern look like in Next, like in a meta framework? And in a lot of ways, you know, again, some people that are still working in PHP or were developers for long enough are just laughing because they're like, yeah, this is how websites were developed for a long time. But you, it's taking a while to learn the new patterns.
And I think, as you just mentioned, I think if you have that background, if you've been around a while, like an old guy like me, then, okay, I've worked with PHP before, and this kind of makes sense again. So if you hadn't worked with anything that did that before, this could be all new.
Yeah, I think that's the, I remember that there's this guy, and we were using Ember. And after a while, he was all about Ember. And then after a while, he said, no, Rails, everything. It's dependable. You don't have to deal with all this, you know, Yes, you know what it's going to do. And I think that that's interesting, right? Because do we just like to torture ourselves on the front end and everything's constantly changing? Even some of the stuff I've been doing recently with the new Angular, it's like, oh, what's the best practice now? Is this the best practice? Is that the best practice? How do you know? You know, by talking to the authors. That's really annoying. And not everybody just go talk to the authors, right?
And there's been that pushback. Like I said, some have just pushed it away and said, no, I'm not going to learn all this. And, you know, you see things like HTMX popular now that keeps the front end very simple, and it unloads a lot of that, you know, to the back end, but it delivers HTML and makes that front end look fairly simple. So there's different approaches for sure. I couldn't say I've heard any one framework that a bunch of people are jumping to, or, you know, when they say they're not coming back. I've heard Vue, I've heard Angular. Of course, Astro is popular right now.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of good really things about Astro. Yep.
And Astro just recently released something, what, a few days ago?
The database.
Right.
Just as the Planet Scale free tier disappears. That's one thing that I have struggled with for students, especially in the back end course. It seems like every year I'm looking for a new free tier. We used to use Heroku, you know, we could deploy a PHP application and use MySQL and have it all on Heroku. And then that went away and I switched things over to REPL, and they had Teams for Education and you could deploy for free. And now they have discontinued their Teams for Education and you can no longer deploy for free. You could still, you know, pull a project in there, but you're going to have to provide card information to actually deploy this so everybody else could access it on the web. So we stopped using that. And right now, as of this semester, we're building a simple Docker file, a Docker container, and uploading the PHP application to render.com that runs in that Docker container. And then, of course, you can have Postgres on Render also. So we're still making it work. But yeah, it would be nice to go year to year and not have to find another new free hosting plan for students, at least, you know. And of course, there are some, like I think DigitalOcean and maybe another one or two. If you get the GitHub education pack out there, they'll get free credits. But what I try to avoid for students, some don't have credit cards, believe it or not. You know, so what I try to avoid is the requirement for entering a card to have that free plan. And that's what I really need to find to offer it to, you know, the entire class, or to be able to require it for the entire class.
It should be more of a priority, you'd think, especially because, my goodness, especially for students. I mean, who hasn't, especially when useEffect and the hooks in React were just coming out, like, who hasn't put a useEffect hook with the wrong dependency array and then accidentally just nuked a backend? I got a hotel in England banned from random.org by accidentally hitting their endpoint an unlimited amount of times back to back. So the idea of being as a student and then just, you know, working on some project late at night and then falling asleep and then waking up in the morning and realize you've racked up $50,000 in AWS fees is not my idea of a fun, fun surprise. So
you think AWS will just say, that's okay, we'll refund the charges?
Sometimes they do, if they're feeling generous.
It'd be scary to be at their mercy, wouldn't it? I saw Vercel recently actually put where you can put a hard cap on the charges too. So if you were to pay to deploy something, that would make you feel better as a student or for a side project.
Well, it's psychological too sometimes with these. I get one every month because I have a little side thing on Firebase for just a handful of people to use. And every month when it's like, here's your bill, and I'm like, uh-oh, and I click it, it's still 2 cents. I'm like, why do you bother to charge me for 2 cents every month? But I still get nervous every time I open that one of these times it's going to say $4,000 or something. Before we get back to our conversation, we wanted to say thank you to This.Labs, who is the sponsor of today's show. If you need help with a project that has failed to deliver on time, or are in need of a team that feels true ownership over your engineering projects, definitely hit up This.Labs. They specialize in helping business leaders ensure their strategic digital initiatives stay on track. Trusted by companies like PlayStation, Capital One, Herman Miller, PayPal, and T-Mobile, you can find them at thisdot.co. That's thisdot.co. Now, let's return to our show.
Dave, what would you say your recommendation is for people who just want to get started in Next?
Just build a simple project. This is what I always do when I'm learning anything. And some of my students or viewers would say, no, not another to-do app, but the to-do app's my favorite. It's got all the CRUD possibilities there. If not, you're going to build some other app that still probably needs to do all of the different CRUD actions as well. So, I mean, whatever you want to build, just build something simple to go, okay, I already have a mental model for how I built this, you know, with something else that I was familiar with. And by the way, anytime anybody asks me, what should I use to build this? And maybe they have that FOMO or thinking this is something new that I should use this because this is the better choice. The best answer is, well, I could say, what do you know? You know, if you're already familiar with something, use what you know. But if you're wanting to learn something new, then I compare it to something I know. So then I'm going to build another simple CRUD app that helps me understand and build a mental model around how I did it with the previous thing I knew. And now how do I do it with the new thing that I'm learning?
I like that. That's smart.
Yeah. It might not be too exciting, but yeah.
Well, I think too, is like, I think some people don't fully understand the idea of practice is that sometimes you want to practice for mastery and sometimes you want to practice for learning something new. Mm-hmm. And I think you need to approach your side projects differently depending on what you're going for. Like if you're going for mastery, then yeah, do that on a side project that you really want to nail down and to go faster on or to get more proficient in. But I think some people, they have a really cool idea for a side project, but then they also use it as a way to learn a new technology without realizing that now you've got two things you can get bored of or tired of or frustrated with, the actual idea of the thing you're building and the technology you're using. And so I think you're right? If you're going to learn something new, maybe an idea that's a little less important to you is maybe a good way to learn it so that you can just stick to the thing that is frustrating, which is the new thing and not the idea.
Yeah. Yeah, set a goal of some type. And that's always my goal with something new. If I'm tackling a new framework, I'm going to build something boring that I already know how to build somewhere else. But then it's going to allow me to compare, you know, apples to apples, I guess, instead of apples to oranges.
This is why the way it works for me is having multiple side projects. So every time somebody says that seems like enough, I say, no, give me just a little bit more. A great example is my guitar teacher, for example. He gives me things. He says, I don't want to overwhelm you. And I'm thinking, no, I need you to overwhelm me because then I'll be motivated. So he gave me all these songs because I like to prove things. He gave me all these songs and I got sick of playing one, which is, it's Jack Johnson Flake, if anybody knows that song. So there's a lot of like muted strings. I'm like, this is not fun to learn. I'm not excited about it. And I've since stopped trying to play it. But I think that's important. Just having, you know, having as many, maybe I shouldn't give that advice, having as many side projects as possible. But
well, that works for you. That can be advice. There are people that are like you, and that's good advice. Yeah.
People are like, are you crazy? When is it good enough?
And that's a good point because there isn't any one, you know, piece of advice that fits everybody. Just like teaching. I don't connect with every student as well. Some like my approach and some don't. And that's why, you know, I have friends that run other YouTube channels and some like the way they present things and some like the way I present things. And it's just different teachers connect with different students. So yeah. Whatever works for you.
Yeah. It's been hard to learn as a mentor even sometimes is that like, sometimes you get that feeling of failure. Like I'm not giving my mentee what they need, but sometimes it's just a stylistic thing. I mean, I'll never forget working with a guy who is like, honestly, the only reason I went to college is because it gives me an important piece of paper. He's like, I hate going to class. I learn so much more by just reading and doing things myself. And I was sitting there going, we could not, it's like we're speaking a different language. Cause for me, I love the structure of a class. I learn everything better within a structure, something I can commit to. And so I was just like, how are we both people working on the same team? But sometimes if it's not working for you, a different style, a different type of project, like you're saying, or a different mechanism for taking in information, that might be the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Or a different song that teaches you how to mute those strings.
True.
Find a song you like better, and then you'll be motivated, right?
Yes. Yes. It's like I'm working with a salesperson right now as well. And he does the same thing. Like, oh, it's going to overwhelm me if we give you another list. I'm like, give me another list already. Dave, what about like your YouTube stuff? So, I mean, you do so much. Do your students know you're a YouTuber?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I started creating the videos for my university students. It was during the pandemic, and it was just easier to communicate that way. So that's how it all started. And I thought, why not just make these videos available for everyone? There's other videos out there like this. It's, you know, there's still plenty of other value that the students get by enrolling and being a student at Fort Hays. And so I don't feel like I'm giving away something that they're paying for. They get a lot more out of the class than just those videos. But at the same time, I thought, let's go ahead and make this available to everyone. And it just kind of slowly grew from there. And I'm sure others have, or you've heard others talk about YouTube. It's what I would call a snowball effect. It starts really slow and it takes a lot of consistency. It may be one of the social media platforms that's the hardest to actually kind of get rolling, or you just stick in there and keep publishing things and eventually it picks up. So after, say, 6 months, I had about 1,000 subscribers. And I think I got 400 of those because Brad Traversy had me put a video on his channel after I had about 600 subscribers. So it took a while. And then at the time, they may have lowered this. I think I've heard they've changed this. But at the time, you had to have about 4,000 watch hours to get monetized. And that didn't happen until April of the following year. So about 9 months into being on YouTube and creating videos every week. You know, it's a slow thing at first. And after a year and a half, I was at 10,000 subscribers. And then another year I was at 100,000. So things just, that's why I compare it to that snowball. It just picks up speed as it goes.
Yeah. All right, Rob, we got to learn from Dave.
There we go. Sometimes it's timing too, right? As a category, I feel like coding has picked up a lot of steam in the last year. There's a store, which is pirate software or whatever. And you know, we got Primogen, Fireship, bunch of people. So a lot of people really kind of starting to penetrate into the algorithm. But that's kind of also what you're talking about, is that snowball effect. Once the algorithm opens the door for you a little bit and starts showing people, if you've got a catalog for people to see and you've been putting in the hours, then it grabs you and takes you in that wave. And if you miss the boat and you wait until it's popular to start, it's really difficult to take advantage of that momentum. So yeah, definitely a difficult and sometimes frustrating process to be yelling at yourself for a while, but you need to put in those hours. I mean, that's kind of maybe true for everything, not just for YouTube, but it's a recipe for success just generally in life.
And what you mentioned there about having that back catalog, it really does help, because I have seen accounts that have started and they had a video take off fairly quickly, but then there's not much left to watch after that video. And it's really hard to build any momentum from that. But I would say feed the algorithm. You know, it also makes it a habit for yourself. Try to publish at least once a week. I've seen, there's a lot of great content out there with channels that don't have that many subscribers. The one thing I see in common, I guess, when I look at those channels and I look at their videos tab, you know, and they haven't published with consistency, or, okay, this was a good video, and then the next closest video was 2 months ago. And, you know, it just doesn't give that algorithm, I think, what it wants also. And I've heard that about Twitter, which I haven't really tried to grow much on Twitter. It just kind of happens from my YouTube channel. But the people that start. The people that tend to tweet, is that still the word for it? Tweet?
I think so.
Zeet.
I think we've largely given up on trying to change the name. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you do that more often, you know, you can build up a pretty big following on there too. So I think it's that feed the algorithm thing. But I don't have any magic advice there. Just staying consistent is the thing that has helped me.
Well, that's amazing. Okay, so check out Dave at Dave Gray Teaches Code on YouTube. And what's your Twitter handle?
Is it Yes David Gray?
Yes David Gray. And you can follow him on Twitter too, or on LinkedIn at David Gray.
Yes David Gray.
Oh, it's also still Yes David Gray. Okay,
yeah,
great.
I have to differentiate because of that famous singer from either Ireland or Scotland over there.
It's like James Quick. I was asking him, I was like, what does Q stand for? James Q Quick, right? Is it really a middle name? Turns out it actually is a middle name. So y'all can find him on Twitter and ask him what Q stands for.
Like David K. Piano. And I just thought his last name was Piano for so long. And then I realized, oh, K is his actual last name.
Yeah. But everybody knows him as David Piano. Well, awesome. Thanks again for having or for being on here and spending some time with us. And we'll see you all next time. Thanks.
Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by This.Labs, a framework agnostic consultancy that specializes in JavaScript. You can find them at this.co/labs. That's THISDOT.CO/labs. For all of your friends and you. Do-ba-do-do-do, yay, query, yay, query. Shout it, yay, queries do. So come on, let's go, 'cause we got a show for you.